From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik.
Today on Transition Lab, we have a great guest, Professor Michael Nelson. He's a distinguished professor at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and an expert on the presidency. In particular, Professor Nelson focuses on second-term administrations. He's written a number of award-winning books and numerous articles on the subject, and his latest book is called Clinton's Elections, 1992, 1996, and the Birth of a New Era of Governance. Professor Nelson is also a fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, which is a center of excellence on the presidency, with whom the partnership has worked very closely on transition-related issues. Professor Nelson, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
So my first question is really an important question, which is you're in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm partial to Corky's Barbecue. Is that your favorite go-to barbecue spot, or do you have another favorite?
Well, I've got to say that no matter what I say, it'll be the most controversial thing in this interview, at least in Memphis, where everybody has their own preference. But I'll just say that Corky's is definitely in contention. But you can start a fight in an empty bar in Memphis about okay. Which barbecue place is best.
Well, tell us about your new book, Clinton's Elections, 1992-96, and the Birth of a New Era of Governance.
Well, I found in looking at presidential elections that I don't think had gotten enough attention. Bill Clinton's election in 1992, after a long string of Republican victories in presidential elections, and then his reelection in 1996, after the Republicans took control of Congress in the 1994 midterm election for the first time in 40 years. I thought there's an amazing story there. And honestly, the way in which Bill Clinton was able to, in essence, remake the Democratic Party, to make it competitive once again, and then show extraordinary resilience after facing a variety of setbacks. I just think it's a great story, but I also think it, in some ways, the astonishing bitterness of the contention between Republicans and Democrats during his presidency, in some ways, set the predicate for the era that we're all in now.
Well, one of the things we talk about on this podcast is transitions. Clinton had a very successful presidency in many respects, record economy, trade deals, budget deficit reduction, you know, lots of innovations. His transition was pretty bumpy. What is your opinion of how President Clinton did when his transition to power in 1992?
Well, it was one of the worst transitions in history. Clinton had been governor of Arkansas, a small state, with an overwhelmingly Democratic and also sort of part-time legislature. And he came to Washington thinking, well, I know how to be a chief executive, and overlooked some important considerations during that transition period. For example, he made invested enormous amount of time and effort into choosing the cabinet, which he wanted to look like America, and in particular, look like the Democratic Party in all its diversity. Overlooked in that process was the selection and organization of a White House staff. Once he became president and realized how much he was leaning on his White House staff and how much he was suffering for the lack of care in putting that staff together, he was often, I won't say often running, he was often stumbling through much of that first year. But Clinton is somebody who has a vast capacity to learn from experience and in particular learn from his mistakes. In some ways, that's the best quality a first-year president can have, because nobody's ever done this job before, or a job quite like it. And so you're going to make mistakes. Some of them are going to be rookie mistakes. Some of them are going to be avoidable mistakes. But the question is, do you learn from those mistakes and get better at the job by doing it? And most presidents do. Clinton certainly did.
Well, let's talk about first years, because you wrote a book, or you edited a book with the Miller Center called Crucible, The President's First Year. And I guess looking back on modern presidential history, which president would you say had the most significant or consequential first year, and why?
That's a great question, and I'll answer it in two ways. If you look at which recent president had the most consequential first year in terms of accomplishing what he said during the campaign he wanted to accomplish, that would be Ronald Reagan, who managed to get through at least a partially Democratic Congress. The House was Democratic, a massive tax cut, reductions in domestic spending, massive increase in defense spending, which were exactly the things he had talked about during the campaign. So his first year worked out in a way that fulfilled the expectations that he brought to the office. In terms of consequential but surprising, no president was caught more off guard by virtue of preparation than George W. Bush with 9/11. He had run for office on domestic issues. He had spent the first 7 or 8 months of his presidency focusing on domestic issues, tax cuts, education, and so on. And then, boom, two planes crash into the World Trade Center in New York. Another plane crashes into the Pentagon. And as he realized almost instantaneously, I'm a wartime president, and this is what my presidency is going to be about.
And I think that one interesting thing about George W. Bush, we've had Josh Bolton, his chief of staff, on this podcast, and he reflected on that. And I think one of the reasons that George W. Bush had the best transition out of power, perhaps of anybody in history, is because he felt like the events overtook him in his first year. And he, really much like Harry Truman, said, I want the next president to be ready and they're going to get my full support. Well, let me ask you a question about Reagan, because Reagan, in some senses, had a very difficult first year, particularly in foreign policy. He appointed a national security advisor who was arguably fairly weak, and Alexander Haig, who didn't get along that well with other cabinet officers. And so basically, you had a weak national security structure and a national security team that warred. In year two of his presidency, he replaced his national security advisor and then appointed George Shultz as Secretary of State, who turned out to be one of the most significant and powerful Secretaries of State in modern history. So would you say that Reagan in the foreign policy era adjusted and improved after year one?
Yes, although it was never quite what it might have been. Certainly putting George Shultz in as Secretary of State stabilized the diplomatic side of American foreign policy. That was a tremendous recovery from the very frustrating experience with Al Haig. But the National Security Advisor was never an effective position in the Reagan presidency. And during his second term, it led to the fiasco of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Well, in one of your articles that I read, you describe a number of key lessons that a president needs to learn. And one of those is to tackle the most difficult issues in the first year. So what's an example of an issue that a modern president didn't tackle, but later wished he tackled in the first year?
Well, you know, Jimmy Carter took office in 1977 at a time when the economy was already in, not only in bad shape, but in bad shape in ways it hadn't been before. Carter, during the campaign in 76, talked about the misery index, which was the sum of the inflation rate and the unemployment rate under President Ford. Traditionally, you know, the idea of economists was you don't have high unemployment and high inflation. So clearly the American economy was heading into a very difficult and unprecedented in some ways a period when he took office. What he did instead of focusing on that was to basically unload a long and extensive agenda of legislative proposals on Congress. And a lot of those proposals had to go through the same two or three committees, which meant that there was no sort of clear vision, no clear priorities, and really no capacity, much less willingness on the part of Congress to deal with all those issues. Meanwhile, the economy continued to suffer.
You wrote another book called The American Presidency, and that traced the evolution of the Office of the Presidency and its occupants. So I guess looking to contemporary times, is there really a historical comparison or anyone similar in our history to President Trump, or is he just cutting a new mold in every respect?
He is cutting a new mold in every respect in this important sense. He's the first president in history with no experience in government, whatever, on taking office. Now, in that sense, he's the culmination of a trend. You know, starting with Carter in 1976, voters reacting to their disappointment with Vietnam and Watergate began electing governors rather than senators and former vice presidents to the office. And the idea was, well, we want people with experience in governing. We just don't want them to be part of that Washington scene. And ever since Carter's election in 76, we've been electing presidents of that kind, political outsiders of one form or another. In some sense, Trump is sort of the ultimate expression of that desire, not just not part of the Washington scene, but not part of the political scene at all. So that's kind of where we've ended up as a country over the last almost half century now, because we simply have lost confidence in the government in Washington and therefore devalue experience in Washington. And now, in some ways, devalue experience in government, period. And that I think, helps set the stage for somebody like Donald Trump to come along. He likes to compare himself to Andrew Jackson, meaning the product of sort of a populist upsurge among the electorate. But Andrew Jackson had been a senator, he'd been a governor, he'd been a general. He had worked in various governmental and political offices before he became president. And Donald Trump had none of that.
Let me ask you this. So you are a scholar on second terms. There are lots of famous scholars, historians in the country. Why did you focus on second terms?
Well, I won't say it's been a focus of mine, but it's something that's been an interest of mine for this reason. It's really hard to think of many, perhaps not any, presidents who have served two terms and whose second terms who have been as successful as their first terms. That's not to say no presidents have had successful second terms, but in almost every case, maybe in every case, there's been a fall off in performance. Now, so why is that? What is it about second terms that, especially given that the president has now had 4 years of experience in the office, what is it about second terms that usually leads to a certain a falling off in performance? That's what has interested me about the subject.
And why is that? What is it that's unique about a second term challenge, or the challenge that a second term president faces?
I think in some ways the seeds of second term disappointment are sowed in the campaign for reelection. So if you're a president running for a second term, basically you've got two plays in the playbook. One is to turn it into a referendum. In other words, if you liked my first term, vote for me again. And the other is to turn it into a choice, meaning if you haven't particularly liked my first term, the guy who's running against me would be even worse. Those are the two plays in the playbook. Neither one of them is really laying the foundation for a second term agenda. And I think, for example, of George W. Bush, who was reelected in 2004, and yet during that campaign, which he turned into a choice election, no matter how unhappy you may be with me, John Kerry would be worse. Okay, he's reelected, and thinking he had stored up political capital for any purpose, jumped straight to Social Security reform, a major overhaul of Social Security. Well, he hadn't really talked about that during the campaign. He talked about it, interestingly, during his first campaign in 2000, and then hadn't done anything about it, and then sort of sprung it on the country at the beginning of his second term, and it went nowhere. It got things off to a very disappointing start for his second term. So I think in some ways, you know, the most important reason among several for a second term disappointment is the kind of campaign that presidents run to get reelected is very different from the kind of campaign that they ran to get him elected in the first place.
And one of the things that I thought was very interesting in your writing is you say that when a president runs the first time, they go through a rough and tumble primary. They're in people's living rooms in New Hampshire and Iowa, and they're really in and with the people. But when they run for a reelection campaign, they're basically running from the Rose Garden, so to speak. And so do you feel like presidents just lose touch with average Americans by year four?
How can they help but lose touch? I mean, they live in such a bubbled environment that it's hard to sort of remember what it is like to live among your people. I mean, for most of us, you know, daily life includes lots of things that keep us in touch with our own limitations. I mean, we have to look for a parking space. We have to, you know, wait in the doctor's office, whatever it may be. Presidents never have to do any of that stuff. And I think the longer they're in the White House, the more rarefied their experience is, for valid security reasons, certainly, but in a way that might make it harder for them to connect with the people with whom they were in such close touch when they ran the first time. So there is a disconnect, and it makes it harder for the president to go into a second term and feel that's and have that same close connection with the people whose support he's ultimately going to need.
One of your arguments is that basically presidents deal with all the issues they put off to the second term in the second term. So what issues do you think that President Trump, if he were to win re-election, what are the big issues that he would need to tackle in the second term that he didn't tackle in the first term?
Well, even before the massive increase in federal spending that's occurred because of the coronavirus crisis, even before that, big tax cut that Trump got through, the big spending increases in domestic and defense policy that he signed were contributing to massive deficits, an enormous increase in the national debt. There's a day of reckoning for that that will come presumably sometime during the next term, whichever president is in office then.
Presidents often have a honeymoon in their first term. They win elections, say, with 50, 51, 52% of the vote, and then suddenly their popularity goes up to 60, 70%, and they have a short honeymoon. I guess two questions. Did President Trump actually have a honeymoon? And or do second-term presidents typically get that honeymoon?
Well, I think the honeymoon effect for second-term presidents has never been there because it's like marrying the same person a second time. I mean, it might end up being a good marriage, but there's not going to be a honeymoon. I think what we've seen recently, though, is that because the country is so polarized politically, even new presidents have a hard time getting the kind of surge of support that marked previous presidents and gave them sort of a grace period when they entered office with the public almost universally wishing them well and wanting them to succeed. I don't know that happens anymore. So I'm not sure that presidents are getting honeymoons period anymore. And it might even be true if Vice President Biden is elected.
So you're saying that if Vice President Biden is elected, he may not even enjoy a honeymoon just because the partisan divide is so deep.
Exactly.
Right. Now, you wrote a book on the first year of modern presidencies with the Miller Center. If you were to write another book on the president's fifth year, which modern president would you say had the most consequential fifth year in office?
Well, I think you'd have to say, taking consequential to mean for better or worse, Richard Nixon. And after winning a 49-state landslide in 1972 with a massive popular vote majority as well, 1973 turned out to be a year in which things fell apart because of the unraveling of the Watergate crisis and ultimately leading to his resignation sort of one step ahead of the posse because he resigned because it was certain that he would be impeached mm-hmm. by the House and convicted by the Senate. In terms of successful fifth years, Bill Clinton had a very successful fifth year, in part because he had managed to, during the final year of his first term, he had managed to find some areas of shared interest with the Republican Congress. Congress became Republican in 1995. It stayed Republican for the rest of Clinton's term. And what he did during 1996, during that election year, was find sort of areas in which both Republicans in Congress and he as president felt they could derive political benefit from cooperating. Welfare reform, raising the minimum wage during his fourth year of his first term. During his fifth year, he and Republicans in Congress managed to strike a balanced budget agreement that led to actual budget surpluses during the last couple years of his presidency. Now, who knows how things would have gone if at the beginning of his sixth year it hadn't been revealed that he'd been having this affair or had had this affair with a young White House intern named Monica Lewinsky. But the fifth year, certainly for Clinton, was a year of accomplishment because both he and the Republicans in Congress found areas where that were win-win, you know, balancing the budget in a way that preserved both parties' priorities was win-win. And Clinton and Congress got there during the first year of his second term.
Let's turn to the subject of Supreme Court appointments, which prior to the coronavirus outbreak probably would have been one of the biggest issues between
a Vice President Biden and a President Trump election contest. So in your book, you write that Supreme Court justices frequently wait to retire until a president sympathetic to their views is elected. So Justice Potter Stewart famously retired right after Reagan was elected. Justice White retired shortly after Bill Clinton was elected. And David Souter, even though he was appointed by a Republican, turned out to be a pretty progressive justice, and he retired shortly after Obama was elected. So the current Supreme Court has two justices in their 50s, three in their 60s, two in their 70s, and Justices Breyer and Ginsburg are in their 80s. So how do you see this playing out if either Trump or Biden wins?
Well, I think if Trump wins, Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg are going to hope to live forever. I recently read that even though the Supreme Court is pretty much shut down during the coronavirus crisis, the one room that's been kept open is the workout room where Justice Ginsburg goes. She's hoping to outlast Trump if he's reelected. I do think that, you know, the actuarial tables have not been repealed. It may be hard for any justice who's already now in their 80s to make it for another, what would be another 5 years. But I would expect that if Biden is elected, he will have the opportunity to make two Supreme Court appointments during his first year, because I would think that Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg would both retire. Now, here's a complication. What if Biden were to win, but the Senate remain in Republican hands? Would that create the possibility that a Biden nominee would be unconfirmable just because he's a Democrat and the Senate is Republican? But we're far away from knowing what the situation's actually going to be.
One of the other fascinating chapters in the book, Crucible, was a chapter by Robert Bruner, a historian, who wrote about eight financial crises that presidents dealt with in their first year. And I went through those eight, and basically they were Adams, Van Buren, Lincoln, Cleveland, Hoover, Roosevelt, and Obama. Of those eight, Bruner basically argues that only three successfully handled the crisis: Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Obama. And they were the only three that were reelected. So what lessons do you draw for today about how the current crisis will affect President Trump's chances for being reelected?
When you get a crisis that is as severe as this one, with unemployment expected to go up to levels not seen since the Great Depression, and so on, all the rest, then I think voters take into account that they can't expect, you know, 3% unemployment, low inflation, 3%, 4% growth this year. They're going to evaluate the president by a different standard, but they're going to want to know, is the president making things better than they would have been otherwise? And that, I think, is the standard that people are going to use to evaluate President Trump's performance. Is he doing as well as anybody could do, given the nature of the crisis? And that's going to be a matter of perception on the part of voters. How do they think another president would have handled it? If they think Trump has handled it as well as any president could have, given the circumstances, then I think they will endorse that effort and his candidacy. And of course, a lot of the campaign will be President Trump arguing, I did as well as anybody could have been expected to do. He'll argue, I did better than any other president in the history of the world could have done. And of course, Biden will be arguing, no, Trump's mistakes have kept things from being better than they ought to be. So both candidates are going to try to shape voters' perception of how well President Trump has done in handling the economic fallout. And that's on top of the public health crisis itself, how well people think he's handling that. And of course, those two things are interwoven, but they're not the same thing. So I think a lot of what's going to happen between now and Election Day is going to be the efforts by both candidates to get voters to sort of see things the way they think is reasonable. And there's no telling how well each candidate will be able to execute that strategy.
Let me close with this question. Everybody loves to rank presidents. When I was a kid, we would rank our favorite presidents. I talk about it with my kids now. So Siena College, I guess, has the most authoritative ranking. I don't know if you agree with that, but in their last survey, the top five presidents ranked by historians were FDR, Teddy Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington. And then of the top 10 presidents ranked by historians, all but two were two-term presidents. And the only two that were not two-term presidents that made the top 10 were Lincoln and Kennedy, who obviously their lives were tragically cut short. The other one was Truman, who basically came into office because of FDR's death. So in your view, does a president really need to be a two-term president to be a truly great president, or can you be a truly great president with only one term?
Well, so much depends on what qualifies one as truly great. But if the working definition we're using here is sort of top 10 or top dozen, I think there's a very good chance that with the passage of time, George Bush will come to have been seen as in that category, even though he was defeated by Bill Clinton when he ran for a second term in 1992. And the reason is that he made the transition from the Cold War to the post-Cold War era in a way that was so skillful and averted so many potential crises that I don't know that anybody could have done it better. If I had to pick one, it would be George Bush. By the way, I never say George H.W. Bush. He was George Bush before George W. came along. And, you know, we didn't ask John Adams to change his name when John Quincy Adams came along. So that's a quirk of mine, but he's George Bush. And he was during his entire presidency. That's how he signed his name.
Well, John Meacham's book on George Bush, 41, I think really makes anybody reevaluate the strength of his presidency. It's a beautifully written book. I read it. And I worked on the Clinton campaign in 92, and obviously I wanted Clinton to win. But when you read Meacham's book, you just realize what a great man George H.W. Bush was and how impactful his one term was. So I agree with you, and thank you for that comment. So, Professor, you have the last word. You can call him George Bush as opposed to George H.W. Bush because you write the books. Let me thank you for your time. Let me thank you for your scholarship. And let me thank you for all the great work that you do at Rhodes College and also with the Miller Center at the University of Virginia.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this enormously.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.